James, will you please? He's become more famous than me.
President Trump inviting former FBI Director James Comey to walk across the blue room of the White House for a handshake. Comey tried to duck out of a quick bro hug from the president. And while awkward, that didn't seem particularly odd or telling when it happened back on Trump's second day in office. But today, after the last few weeks the president has had, that scene has taken on a lot more significance. And so politics is where we will begin the show today with Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider and host of Left, Right and Center. They are doing a special hour-long show this week, and you can hear it at 2:30 today and again at 7 o'clock. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks, Madeline.
Just an hour? I bet you could just fill the entire afternoon with everything that's going on.
Yeah, we could have. There's no shortage of news right now. We could fill as much time as we are given by KCRW.
Right. And so as the president goes away on his first foreign trip, what does it look like here at home? How much damage has he done to his presidency?
Well, a lot, I think. Although, I mean, it's funny. I don't think the primary impacts of this are financial, but you saw the move in the stock market after it came out that these Comey memos existed, and you know, about a 500-point drop in the Dow. And I think that's a recognition that Trump really may be doing a lot of political damage to himself that imperils the legislative agenda that he hopes to put forward, and maybe even his presidency itself. You've also seen a real change in tenor and comments coming out of Republicans in Congress being more openly critical of the White House. Senator Bob Corker, who's sort of a good establishment bellwether of Senate Republicans who are neither close to the center nor close to the far right, was saying that the White House is in a downward spiral and needs to change what it's doing. And you even had at least two Republican members of the House of Representatives raising the specter of impeachment, saying that if Donald Trump did what is allegedly described him doing in that Comey memo, trying to get the FBI director to stop the investigation into Mike Flynn, that could rise to the level of being an impeachment matter. It's really unusual to have a situation where members of the president's own party are talking about impeachment, or even when they're saying that he should not be impeached, people are not really talking about it like it is a ridiculous idea anymore, and we're only 4 months into his presidency.
And yet, with the appointment of Robert Mueller to lead the investigation, does that not let Republicans off the political hook in a way that they can say, okay, let's just wait for this to play out, and it will likely take many, many months, if not years, for it to play out until we do something?
I don't think so, for a couple of reasons. One is that usually when you have something like this, you have a White House that is disciplined and refuses to answer questions about the investigation and says, well, a special counsel is looking at that and we're not going to comment on an ongoing investigation. I think it's very unlikely that the president will be able to stifle himself and stop fanning the flames of all of these scandal discussions. I think you're also going to see a continued parade of leaks and disclosures, some of which are not leaks. There's been this subpoena for these memos to file that James Comey created. You've seen a steady drip of news, including just today, this afternoon, that the president had told the Russian ambassador in this meeting shortly after he fired James Comey that he had just fired the FBI director and that the guy was a real nut job, and that this took great pressure off of him around Russia. So I think politically, the existence of the investigation doesn't insulate the president for a period. I also think, when people think of special prosecutors, they think of things that drag on forever. And you had Ken Starr for years, starting by investigating Whitewater and years later landing on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I have a sense that there is just so much material here, that there is going to be stuff to be dealt with fairly quickly. It's not going to take years and years for Bob Mueller to find something. Now, I'm not saying that the president specifically himself committed a crime, and even if he did, the president can't be indicted while he is in office. But I mean, the Mike Flynn's activities with being paid by associates of the Turkish government while he was advising on policy in the White House and having failed to register as a foreign agent, and Paul Manafort's various financial dealings. It strikes me that there is a deep vein here and that it may not take very long for the special prosecutor to find what he's looking for.
Okay, so meanwhile, you have Vice President Mike Pence. He's starting a political action committee this week. Why is he doing that? And could that be seen as competing with his boss for donors?
Yeah, so this is quite unusual for a sitting vice president of a first-term president to be setting up a political organization of his own. Now, the purpose of this political action committee will be to raise money for Republican members of Congress. So there's a good story here, which is that Mike Pence is out there raising money to support the congressional majority that they need to advance their agenda. But usually the vice president would do this within the auspices of the president's political operation. The advantage of having your own committee is that if, for example, circumstances were to change such that Mike Pence wished to run for president in 2020, then he would have the fundraising information, the donor lists from that political action committee. It would be an advantage to him when he would then go and try to run for president himself. So I don't think he's necessarily expecting to do that. But it's not just the financial markets and people in Congress who are noting the increased possibility that Donald Trump will not make it all the way to 2020. It has to be weighing on Mike Pence's mind as well. And the PAC would be useful for him if that happened.
But then how does Trump see that? Does he see this as sort of a betrayal by Mike Pence?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Mike Pence overall has generally positioned himself very much as a good soldier. We haven't seen him break publicly with the president at all. And again, there is an innocent explanation for the PAC, which is that it's here to help Republicans elected to Congress. And of course, it's not anything about opposition to Donald Trump. And you've seen people around Mike Pence and spokespeople for Mike Pence trying to distance him from these various scandals in the White House, claiming with various levels of plausibility that Pence was unaware of the things going on around him. In particular, this news this week that it was known to the Trump transition that Mike Flynn was under investigation for his business activities with Turkey. Mike Pence's spokesman says that Pence was unaware of that until March, and yet Mike Pence was in charge of the transition, and the national security advisor is one of the most important hires and one of the earliest hires that was identified by the Trump transition. So if Pence wasn't aware of that, then it would seem like he wasn't doing his job very well at the transition.
Right. And then could that be also one area where the special prosecutor, he looks into that, and Mike Pence is then under investigation as well?
I don't think there's any allegation that Mike Pence would have committed a crime there. I don't know what crime that would have been. I mean, it was certainly a major political error and a major, you know, substantive error to allow Mike Pence into this position of authority. But A, it was ultimately the president's decision who to appoint. The transition, you know, they oversee, you know, recruiting and vetting of people and those sorts of things. But it wasn't up to Mike Pence to make Flynn not national security advisor. And I certainly haven't seen any allegation that Pence himself did anything criminal there.
Well, you raised the issue that David Frum raised on the show earlier this week, and that is that this special prosecutor does only look at issues of lawbreaking and doesn't look at larger issues such as what is appropriate and what is not and what is a danger to national security and what is not. And so there are some calls from both sides for an independent commission. Do you think that would ever happen in this Congress?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, I think it looked like Republicans were going to fiercely resist a special counsel until politics shifted this week and it became untenable to resist a special counsel. And so I think certainly you could have circumstances in which Republicans in Congress saw fit to agree to an independent commission. But the other thing is, you know, Congress is conducting its own investigations as well through the intelligence committees in the House and the Senate and through some other committees as well. And one of the reasons that you would want an independent commission is that those committee processes are too political. That you saw, I mean, Devin Nunes clearly cooperating with the White House to try to stall the investigation in the House Intelligence Committee. But if you had a shift in Congress such that they were willing to establish an independent commission, then that shift would also seem to imply that the Congress would be willing to conduct a real investigation under its own auspices. So I think, you know, I agree with David that an independent commission would be a good thing, but I think the circumstances in which we would get it would be circumstances in which the committee process might actually work fairly well in its own right.
All right. We'll end it there. Thanks so much, Josh.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So that's Josh Brero. He's senior editor at Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. And if you want more of him and his guests, you can get it. They have a special one-hour show today at 2:30 and repeat it again at 7. And also, you can download their podcasts wherever you get your podcasts, Left, Right, and Center. Okay, now to local politics. California has the largest Democratic Party in the nation, so it could be key to switching the House from red to blue in the midterms. Activists this weekend will talk strategy and pick a new leader. There are two main candidates in the running, Kimberly Ellis and Eric Bauman. Bauman is a party insider. He's a gay activist and a union organizer here in L.A. Ellis is a party outsider from the Bay, supported by the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and she could be the first person of color to lead California's Democratic Party. Here to talk about all this is Carla Marinucci, reporter for Politico, covering state politics. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, tell us more about these two candidates. Is this yet another proxy war between the Hillary and Bernie wings of the party?
That's exactly how it's being described, the Bernie-crats versus the Hillary folks. Bauman, somebody who's almost grew up in the Democratic Party, he's 58. He's this tough-talking party operative, a guy who has been working the Democratic roles for many, many years, an aggressive, you know, Bronx-born guy. So right out of central casting, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. But, you know, Kimberly Ellis, a relative newcomer to the party, but somebody who certainly knows the ropes. She was the director of Emerge America, which is a very influential group trying to get women to run for political office, trying to school them on how to run for political office, African-American mother of two, and somebody who said, look, it's time for new faces, new voices in the party, much as many of the Bernie-crats have said. It has been a rather caustic and combative contest to replace John Burton, who's been a legend in this party. He's held this job since 2009, but of course, before that, he was the Senate pro tem here in California and also a congressman, somebody who's well known for his, well, let's say foul mouth, but,
yes.
but tough talk. And somebody who has really kept the party together in a lot of ways. And I talked to him on this week, and he said, look, this is going to be a hard-fought election, but Democrats have to remember that the real enemy is the, I can't say it on the public radio, Donald Trump.
So, right.
The Democrats are hoping by the time it's over, that's where they're going to be. If not unified, then at least looking all at the same target at the White House.
But what does it look like inside the party in terms of who has the upper hand?
In the beginning, a long time ago, Bauman seemed to have racked up all the elected officials in terms of endorsements. He seemed to have just a lock on this thing. But Kimberly Ellis, we've talked to her, she's gone far and wide in California to a lot of the rural areas, talking to sort of average folks, not party insiders, and many of them have kind of signed up for her, and now it looks really, really close. This could go down to the wire, and that's one of the reasons I think this race has been interesting. She has sort of come from out of nowhere to a lot of folks, but the fact is she's done her homework. She's done a lot of hard work going up and down the state. And Bauman's had some issues in that some of the Democratic progressives have said that he, at least his firm, consulting firm, backed some big drug companies or worked with some big drug companies. There were clients in the last big Prop 61 fight. That's had him a little bit of a problem. But then this race was even roiled in the last couple of weeks by sort of anonymous emails that went out to folks attacking Bauman. It has just been a really interesting race all the way around. It's going to be interesting to watch how this turns out on Sunday because, as you said, what happens in California matters for fundraising, for money, for grassroots activism, and for those seven vulnerable House GOP seats that may be up in 2018.
So what are the major areas where they disagree on, and how could that shift the focus of the California Democratic Party?
Well, they really don't disagree on the major issues confronting Democrats. When you're talking about single payer, when you're talking about, you know, LGBT rights, reproductive rights, a path to citizenship, they agree on all those things. Mm-hmm. It's really on how the party operates. Bauman has said, look, the California Party is one of the most successful in the nation. Of course, the Democrats control both houses of the legislature, every statewide office, and he said that California is sort of a template of what the rest of the country should do. too. Kimberly Ellis says, well, if Mr. Bowden was so successful in Los Angeles, why is the turnout so low, particularly in Los Angeles County? What the party needs to do is sort of take a whole new grassroots approach to organizing, and she's suggesting that the insiders need a new, fresh look at what's going on. So that's really the difference, is the operational aspect, the outlook, and how much the party needs to sort of freshen its look with some new faces in there.
Well, one of the issues is money, right? And that Kimberly Ellis is saying the party is dominated by too much big money, from what I understand. But isn't that kind of the key, that their job is to raise money for these candidates?
Yeah, in one sense, Madeline, you're absolutely right. I mean, money is everything. And Eric Bauman has said, look, I've been a proven fundraiser in this party. I know how to get it done. I know how to elect people. But people also point to that consulting firm, and his consulting firm's work with Big Pharma. And they say that is the kind of thing that shouldn't be happening, and that the party needs to go back to, Ellis is claiming, the party needs to go back to emphasizing, much as Bernie Sanders did, those small donors, not the big corporate interests. And so you do have this setup of the left versus the left in this race.
Okay. And meanwhile, the gubernatorial candidates are all going to be there, right, strutting their stuff?
This is going to be very interesting. I mean, this is the place where the party is going to gives people a chance to meet and greet the 3,000 activists who are going to show here, but also to start beginning to get their message out. And on the gubernatorial side, of course, we have Gavin Newsom, who's throwing a huge street party with the Common, which ought to be really a hot item to go to. But then there's also State Treasurer John Chang, former school superintendent Delaine Easton, and of course former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villagrosa. All of them are going to be addressing the convention, but we're also going to see Tom Steyer, who a lot of people think may also be running for governor.
He's the billionaire environmentalist.
Yeah, the billionaire environmental activist. And then there's State Senate Pro Tem Kevin De Leon, who hasn't announced for anything, but who today put out a ad that looks suspiciously gubernatorial, and a lot of people say he may be getting into the race maybe in the next month.
Oh, interesting. Okay. everyone come in. Why not? Carla, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Carla Marinucci, reporter for Politico. She covers California politics. We'd love to hear from you. Which direction would you like to see the party go in? You can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, a new documentary tells the intimate story of a group of men in Aleppo, Syria, who try to save their neighbors when the bombs fall. I'll speak with the Syrian director of Last Men in Aleppo next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Donald Trump travels to Saudi Arabia today and then on to Israel. It's a big moment in the region, but it won't mean much to the people in the Syrian city of Aleppo, and that's because there's hardly anyone left there. Aleppo was once Syria's largest city. 2.3 million people lived there before the war. It was the country's financial center, its old city, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Now, few civilians are left in the city. The buildings are hollowed out shells. There's rubble everywhere. Food is scarce. Electricity spotty. And there's the constant threat of bombs falling from Syrian or Russian aircraft. Until recently, when those bombs fell, a small group of volunteers called the White Helmets would rush to the bombing site to try to rescue people buried under the rubble. In the documentary Last Men in Aleppo, Syrian filmmaker Firas Fayyad follows a few members of the White Helmets on rescue missions. It is dangerous work. Many of the White Helmets died as they tried to save lives. Last Men in Aleppo won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It opens tonight at Lemley's Music Hall. And Firas Fayyad joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You follow two men in particular in your movie. One is named Khaled. The other one is Mahmoud. Khaled is a father of two young children. Mahmoud is 29 years old, and his family is in Turkey, mainly. He has his brother with him, but the rest of his family's in Turkey. Why do they stay in Aleppo? What kept them there?
Yeah. Like my father and my mother, why they stay in Aleppo? It's like their home, which is like they don't have other alternative solution for that. This is their home where they should go. I mean, they have to stay because this is their house. They're in this place they grow up, and this is place they have all their memories. They know their language. They know how they love in this place.
Talk a little bit about a scene in your movie. It's early on in the movie where the white helmets go to excavate some civilians, and they pull out the bodies of small children, of babies. And one child survives, the babies do not. And Mahmoud, who is one of the white helmets, he's one of the ones who rescues the boy and pulls out the bodies of the babies. And then he goes to visit the boy and his family. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why he did that, why he felt the need to see this boy.
Mahmoud, normally he didn't visit the victim. And he decided, like, because he saw those children, like, his brothers, and he want to protect his brother. And he felt like something reflect him. And he decided like to visit because he heard that one of them is killed, that he rescue him, and he felt in responsibility. And he go like to there, and he just like to check if this is right, because they didn't find the children, because they are like limbs and parts. And then he checked that the boy was alive, and he felt like happy, just like. And the feeling of the boys was like surprised for me as a filmmaker. It's just like he go like to and sit like next to Mahmoud, and it was like one of this is very emotional and effective moment that this is boy, he saw like a guy, he's help him, and he catch his hand, and Mahmoud was like shocked and a little bit like confused. He couldn't know what he should do, and he felt like shy, a little bit shy, and then he getting angry because he. For him, what he do, he doing like for just rescue this children, rescue the families, and then he disappear.
Yeah, so he didn't want to be seen.
Yeah, because he feel like this is feeling, it's like it show off. He don't want to show that he rescue and tell the people, I do that.
And he didn't want to show off.
No. So he feel like it's show off, and especially the camera in front of him and like record this moment, and he said, I'm not going to visit again any other victim, because for him, like, it's wrong. I should not do that. Yeah.
But he's a young guy, and here he is surrounded by death. He's pulling the bodies of dead babies out from under the rubble. He must be mentally affected by this. How does this affect the White Helmets? How does it help? How does it affect people like Mahmoud, Khaled, emotionally and mentally to be doing this every day?
Khaled is just like 30 years old. He's grew up also like in with the war, like 6 years. I mean, also Mahmoud is 29 years old, and his brother 26. So this is young people. The White Helmets was like the ground to this young people to find themselves, to not fall down in ISIS group or armed group or different group. They just find themselves in this group. This is the right way, and this is the right place that should they do something for their countries. Mentally, it's balanced. I understand them because this is what's happened with me. I'm a Syrian, and this is the same situation happened with me. I mean,
do you feel like making this movie helping you?
Yeah, this is movie is helping me because this is what my responsibility about what before, like when I finished my film school and go, I was just my goal, like picked up a good story and do fun stories and showing this story and around the world and do the other and next. But after that, after what's happened in Syria, and I felt like the movie that I do, it's more responsibility. It's more about feeling that this is that I have to do now. Without that, I'm gonna have a painful on all my life, because this is what I saw in my eyes. This is what I experienced in when I've been in the prison two times, when I've been in the street and I saw the death in front of me. It's not like just business work, career work. And
it's like a mission for you.
Yeah, it's mission, life mission, justice mission. It's documented the history. It's writing the history from the perspective of the weakness, not the perspective of the power. It's against the dictatorship who have the weapon, who control everything, who can change the reality. We are just trying to use what we have in our hand, the poor things, which is the art and filmmaking, and changing the reality and changing the mind of the people to help us, to involve with us, to be witnesses with us. Everyone who watched the movie, he barred from witnesses on the crime, and he have to do, he fell in responsibility with us to do any act to change the reality around him.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with the director of Last Men in Aleppo. It's a documentary. It opens tonight at the Lemley Music Hall. I'm speaking with Firas Fayyad. There was a really affecting scene in your movie where Khaled takes his daughters to a playground, and it's packed with people because it's the only playground around, and there's a fair few old slides. I mean, it's nothing great, but the kids are so happy. They're so happy, and the adults are so happy because they get to play as well. They get to take a break from the war. But then it's over so quickly because...
Yeah.
You know, the planes are flying overhead.
Yeah, it's a space that the people, they try like to find the meaning of their life. And also like when we have everything around us like a death, how much has have a power as a human being to find places for the hope. And the adult like was trying to use the children as accused like to play. Just, I mean, they want like to play also.
They want to have a fun.
They want to have a fun. I mean, they want to have a fun. I mean, this is what's happened with us. We want to searching about the love and the life, and we want to have a fun. But the Russian flight didn't allow them. It's 15 to 25 bombing from the sky. Just from the sky, there is like also the missiles coming from the sea and from the surrounding the city.
The missiles, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's from different resources, like the bombing from the city. Russian is destroyed. It. There is no humanity. There is no thinking about this children, civilians. This is film show. There is a two child, like Khaled of child also survived from this is like tragedy. It's from this is like Holocaust that happened in Syria. And they survived, and now the family of Khaled in Istanbul, and the wife of Khaled, she get a baby, and she call it Khaled also. And this is like...
I mean, I'll say it because you said it. I didn't want to give it away, but that Khaled, you follow him through the movie, and he dies.
Yeah.
And he's got these two little girls.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like a lot of white helmets volunteer, most of them the same things. They left behind them a lot of families,
so those
children.
Little girls,
yeah, they don't have.
They're devastated.
They don't understand what's mean Assad, what's mean Putin, what's mean rebels, what's mean. They don't understand. The families don't understand. Even the white helmet, even Khaled, he just saw that the aircraft of Russian. They know that this is green, this is Russian, and this as this regime. This is, he don't have this political plan in his life. He's a normal man, ordinary person who's like grow up in Syria. He want to do, continue his life with his family like anyone.
What is it that we don't understand about Syria, do you think, here in the West?
Actually, that the most things like that misunderstood about the Syrians, they are a human, not just like a subject of the war. This is important. People in Syria, like people in US, they have the same goals in their life, and they have same feeling. They have love stories, and they have families, and that what I want to show it in my films. They have same struggle between your responsibility about your job, and between your responsibility about your child.
Firas Fayyad, he's the director of the documentary Last Men in Aleppo. It opens tonight at Lemley's Music Hall. Thank you. Coming up, movie reviews this week, the latest in Ridley Scott's Alien franchise, and a couple of unique takes on suburban life.
Complications ensue, chain smoking and drunken nights and skinny dipping.
Our fabulous film critics are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If this planet is too much to handle right now, maybe escape this weekend to another planet. Virtually, you can at least. Another alien movie comes out today. So it's time now for new movie reviews. Matt Atchett is here, editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Welcome back.
Hello. Good to see you.
Nice to have you. Up first, the latest from director Ridley Scott. Here's a clip from Alien Covenant.
We're making history here.
This is wheat. What are the odds of finding human vegetation this far from Earth?
Who planted it? You hear that?
What?
Nothing. No birds. No animals. Nothing.
Except
there
might
be
something right around the corner. Christy, how different is this from Prometheus?
I guess you need to have seen Prometheus to get a lot of what matters here. But if you have never seen Prometheus or any other alien movie for that matter, I think you'd be okay here because it's so visceral and gripping and intense, beautifully shot, great cast, beautifully acted. It's really good. I mean, if you are deeply steeped in the alien canon, you'll dig it. But if you are not, you can still go into this just wanting a good time, wanting the thrill of it, and you'll get that.
And this is a prequel-ish thing, right?
Yes, this is a sequel to Prometheus and a prequel to all the other Alien movies.
Right.
I like this one a lot, too. In six words, totally beautiful, completely predictable, still effective. It gives you hints at things that you see coming a mile away. Absolutely. There aren't a lot of surprises here. That's okay. It's fine because it's so effective. Everybody does their job really well. I also want to call out Danny McBride in this as playing a character that, or at least a role in a serious movie that we don't normally get to see him in. And he's really good. But the rest of the cast is as well. Michael Fassbender puts in another terrific performance.
And he plays a robot, right?
He does. Yes.
That's all we'll say. But he's chilling.
He is. I like this. And look, like, this is a gross out movie. It is not for the squeamish, but this is the alien movie that everybody wanted out of Prometheus and didn't get.
Oh, good. Well, I'm a fan of the first two from way back.
I think you'll like this one.
You'll dig it, yeah.
Okay. Moving on to something different. This is also from the way back, from the 1970s, although it's a new movie. It's called The Commune from director Thomas Vinterberg. And we're not going to play soundbite because it's in Danish. So I don't know if many people will understand it in our audience. But Christy, what did you think?
So it is kind of based on Thomas Vinterberg's childhood. He actually grew up in a commune like this outside of Copenhagen. And Thomas Vinterberg is one of the founders of the Dogma 95 filmmaking manifesto. So it's about, you know, handheld camera and natural light, and it's supposed to be very stripped down. But the emotions are high, and intense stuff happens when this husband and wife and their teenage daughter move into the husband's childhood home. And they can't afford to keep it, just the three of them. So it's the 70s, so the wife invites random people to come and live with them. And emotional...
As everybody did in the 70s.
Right, emotional complications ensue, chain smoking and drunken nights and skinny dipping. And it's really beautifully acted. You kind of don't know where things are going. There are various entanglements and twists. It's a fascinating slice of life in looking into a life that I'm not sure anybody would really want to live themselves.
So she invites her husband's affair, a much younger woman, into the commune.
Right. So, yeah, the husband is a professor and he has an affair with one of his grad students. And just, you know, open-minded, if everyone's cool with it, let's just bring the mistress along, too. And it gets much more complicated than anybody expects. And the actress who stars in it, whose name I am blanking on, I apologize, is tremendous in this. She plays a TV news anchor. She has huge range. So it's a very adult drama. If you want a grown-up, meaty, serious drama, this is that.
And is this in Thomas Vinterberg's oeuvre? Is this is this vintage Vinterberg?
Yeah, you know, the reviews that we have on Rotten Tomatoes are mostly positive. It's at 73% right now. And, you know, I think that this is going to at least give you insight into kind of where he comes from, right? Because it is kind of, you look at Dogma, the Dogma movement, and you think, okay, well, I guess I could kind of see where someone ends up with that based on where they came from. So I love movies that are a snapshot of where the director came from or the writer came from. I always think that's a really interesting insight.
Because the last movie I saw of his was Far From the Madding Crowd, which was set in England at a different costume time
drama.
Period. Yeah, it's totally different.
True to his roots.
Lots of good lighting in that one. Okay. Moving on to An American Suburb Now. Our next film stars Bryan Cranston and Jennifer Garner. Here's a clip from Wakefield.
Suburban life. So much is the same. Week after week. Who hasn't had the impulse to put their life on hold for a moment? Just vanish completely.
Okay, Matt, so he does. He vanishes completely. What happens?
So this man comes home, chases a raccoon out of his attic over his garage, and stays in the attic for almost the whole year. Disappears from the lives of his family and friends, and without a trace, and doesn't tell them. And all through this, there's this narration from this character, Wakefield is his last name, done by Bryan Cranston. And you see him watching his wife and you see him watching his kids, and you get flashbacks to kind of how he has perceived them and thinks about them. And there is a little bit of the unreliable narrator in this, shades of that, not really obviously, but I really, really like this movie. There's a chilling aloofness to this character, and it's fascinating. And it's based off an E.L. Doctorow short story that was in The New Yorker about 10 years ago. Mm. And I think that this is great. I really hope people give it a chance. It's an amazing performance from Cranston. I found him to be riveting. And a really good performance from Jennifer Garner as well, who has this tough role playing most of her scenes. You're seeing her kind of through two windows, from his point of view. He's looking through the window in the attic across the driveway into the window of the house, and you see her, and she still manages to kind of convey what she's doing and who she is, and inhabits this performance in a really interesting way. I loved this movie.
Yeah, it's a very showy role for Bryan Cranston, and it's pretty much wall-to-wall narration, which at first I was like, ugh, is he going to explain everything? But that it provides such fascinating and darkly humorous perspective, and you see him go from button-down Burberry suits, high-powered lawyer job in the city, to just disheveled homeless guy digging through dumpsters for food. And so it's a massive physical range, but also a massive emotional range, which of course he can pull off. And you change how you feel about him throughout the course of the film, because what he's doing is despicable. He has abandoned his family. It's totally selfish. But then you come to understand why he's chosen to do that, and your feelings become as complicated as his
so
feelings.
So you're in the attic with him.
Very
in
much.
In
we are all in our own attic. Madeline.
Got it.
Yeah, no, it's really good though.
So this sounds a little bit like what he did on Breaking Bad, where he starts off as a normal guy and then just descends into this madman, really.
Right. Well, externally, he appears to be a normal guy by all the trappings of what we consider to be successful in the modern day. But the flashbacks reveal the kind of twisted relationship that he had with Jennifer Garner, which cause their relationship to deteriorate somewhat. And so you understand that it's a facade.
Right. There's a cruelty to this character that is interesting, and yet you kind of understand it. And I think between his performance and the direction from Robin Swycord, she plays you like a violin. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the ending is something else. I absolutely didn't see the ending coming. I hadn't read the story first. And I was really, really impressed with this movie. And again, it's chilling, and he is despicable, but you start feeling for him like you do in Breaking Bad, and you go on that journey, and at no point does he do anything that doesn't really make sense. That's, I think, kind of the best part of this film is...
But you know at the same time he's crazy, or...
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Or is he?
Well, that's the thing, is you think, you do think, oh my God, I could never do that, but he puts it in all such a logical way and a reasonable, like it sounds reasonable, right? You know, he sells it, right? And part of this is Cranston's performance. He sells the mindset of this character. And it's, I know I'm kind of like overpraising this, but I really, really like this.
Yeah, Robin Swycourt is a longtime screenwriter. I think this is maybe only the second film she's directed. And I love that it comes from a woman.
Yeah.
But, and I think because of that, you do have a great variety of complexity of perspectives. It's not black and white.
All right. Well, that's exciting. Good movies to watch this weekend.
There's hope.
At least on screen. Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Matt Atchedy, editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, coming up on this program, Seth Meyers is here. He'll talk about why his nightly comedy show leads with the news. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is how Seth Meyers covered the news last night.
I just wish someone had warned us about the disastrous consequences of a president who would be under investigation while in office.
This is collusion and corruption of the highest order, and is one more reason why I ask my attorney general, I will ask, to appoint a special prosecutor.
It's literally the only campaign promise he's actually kept.
Seth Meyers' opening segment, A Closer Look, is basically highlights of the day's news with plenty of satire, of course. Seth Meyers joins us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, so you've dispensed with a traditional monologue, right? You sit at this desk and you do the news recaps. How did you decide this was the way to go? First question. And second, how do you keep up when news is breaking maybe after you're taping your show?
Well, as for the first part, we did try a conventional monologue when we started the show, and it was something that I wanted to do to prove to everybody that I wasn't just the guy behind the desk at Weekend Update. And then after about 18 months, I realized, you know, I was pretty good at being the guy behind the desk. I don't know who I'm trying to impress here. And that just helped my comfort level starting from a sitting position. And as for keeping up with the news, we have just evolved, I think, as a staff to the point where we're a lot better at catching things that happen at 4 or 5 in the afternoon, not just on the writing side, but we have incredible researchers, people who build graphics under the gun. And in a weird way, we all thought the election was the World Series because we didn't think this would be the outcome. Mm-hmm. And what we've realized was the election was spring training for this. And so we learned a lot during the election process and how fast the news came then that I think got us in shape for how fast the news is coming now.
Yeah. So Jon Stewart would always say, look, I'm not a journalist. I'm a comedian, even though a lot of people would look to The Daily Show for their news. How do you view yourself? Because you definitely have an anti-Trump point of view. So you're definitely talking to a certain group of people.
Well, again, I think everybody has a point of view. I think that's what makes comedy interesting. And I think it's a mistake to get caught up in let's be even-handed about who we – let's make sure we attack both sides equally. I think right now we just try to be fair, and it seems like one side is producing a lot more that we find to be false and outside the norm. So that's where the comedy is, and that's where we're going to go and get it. I mean, we don't think of ourselves as anti-Trump. I know it comes across that way. I think we think of ourselves as anti-everything he's doing because it's, you know, again, call a lie a lie is basically one of the things we're trying to do. And so, yeah, it looks like we're anti-Trump, but it's only because he lies all the time.
Okay, I want to go back in time a couple years ago to the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011 when you famously roasted Donald Trump.
I love going back there.
I mean, it's really funny. It's really harsh. And as you are going at him over and over again. The camera cuts to his face, and he is just stone-faced. Here is a sample.
Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke. Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. If you're at the Washington Post table with Trump and you can't finish your entree, don't worry, the fox will eat it.
You know, some people have said that that dinner and your jokes, as well as Barack Obama's comments, kind of sealed the deal for him, made him want to run for office.
Yeah, I've heard that theory. The funny thing was, during the election, when I was very confident that he was not going to win, I read a couple articles that focused on President Obama's jokes and sort of left me out. And it really hurt my feelings because I wanted to be part of this theory. And then as soon as he won, I realized they were right. And this was really Obama's fault. And I had nothing to do with it.
But in a way, you know, looking back in time at that moment, you probably couldn't have possibly realized that he indeed would become the president of the United States.
Oh, God, no. I mean... one of the things that we continue to stress over the course of this year on our show, and anytime I run into people socially who want my take on things, is I constantly have to remind them that I have been wrong about everything. The one job that I will not get as a next one after this is a fortune teller. So, yeah, I mean, the other thing I will say is, if we were the ones who convinced him to run, all America had to do was then not vote for him. I'm not going to totally own it. I feel like I set it up perfectly for this to have a different outcome.
Okay, so there are a lot of people, comedians on TV right now doing this brand of humor. It sort of seems irresistible. Colbert, of course, John Oliver, Trevor Noah, Samantha Bee. And Jay Leno was quoted recently in the New York Times saying that basically you look at the late night spectrum and it could be called "What Did Trump Do Now?" And he thinks maybe late night hosts are taking it too far, and that... you know, there's kind of an overload and that you become anesthetized. What do you make of that? Do you think that, in a way, joking about him is not normalizing him, but making us not take him as seriously as maybe we should?
Well, we try very hard in our pieces to have a thesis to our closer looks that point out that this is very serious. We think that people consume it more than they would if it was just a piece, you know, on the news about the same serious issues, if we put a lot of jokes in. But, you know, our conclusions to the closer look are never, isn't this fun? Tune in tomorrow for more madcap moments. It's always, hey, this is a really serious attack on First Amendment rights, or this is outside the norm, and it's time for Republicans to ask themselves where the line is. So, you know, we're framing it both as comedy, but also, hey, this is information and it's the end of a long day and maybe you haven't had as much time to watch cable news and read Twitter as we have. So here is some information that we think is important to you. And again, I think having different kinds of late night shows is important. And I have a lot of respect for what Jay did in that he was trying to tell a bunch of jokes about everything that was going on. But we're very happy with the way we approach it every night.
Seth Meyers, host of Late Night on NBC. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now let's just take a second to think about how insane the last 8 days have been. On Monday, we learned that then-President Obama warned Trump not to hire former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. On Tuesday, Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, which Comey found out about on TV. On Wednesday, he met in the Oval Office with Russian diplomats, including an accused Russian spy. On Thursday, he admitted that he fired Comey specifically because of the Russian investigation. On Friday, he threatened Comey with secret tapes of their conversations. On Saturday, the Justice Department began interviewing new candidates for FBI Director. Yesterday, we learned that Trump gave the Russians highly classified information. And today, we learned that Trump asked Comey to shut down the FBI's investigation into Flynn. And if you're wondering why I didn't mention Sunday, that was Mother's Day. So obviously, Trump was doing what all normal husbands do, spending the day alone on the golf course in a different state. Which, in fairness, is the best gift he could have given her.
Just another week in the news, just another week on TV.
Boy.
Hey, Christian Bordahl.
Hey there, Madeline Brand. Nuts. It has been crazy, and listening to Seth Meyers just reminds me what I've been missing. Because I never get to stay up and watch the late night shows anymore because I have to be up so early and coming.
Well, that's what YouTube is for.
Are you playing the violin?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm so
that's very sad. Yeah. But we asked our listeners whether late night is getting too political because we were going to have Seth Meyers come on and talk to us. And Corky Fullerton Foundry said Seth Meyers is heir to Jon Stewart. So he enjoys Seth Meyers. He's all for it.
Okay. Well, he's great. And there's lots of that political humor out these days, as
it sure is.
Have noted. So no shortage of that.
And no shortage of political news to drive it.
That's true.
Make it happen.
Final thoughts. From Christian Bordahl. Thank you very much. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend, stress-free, hopefully. I'll see you on Monday.